This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, in for Terry Gross. When Joe Kane traveled the Amazon 10 years ago, he was shot at, suffered malaria, and came close to drowning many times. He chronicled his journey down that treacherous river in his first book, Running the Amazon. Kane went back to the Amazon in the early 90s, this time to the rainforest deep inside Ecuador, to find a small nomadic tribe of warriors called the Huarani. They were in a fight with the multinational oil companies that were polluting and damaging their land while producing oil in the region. Kane lived and traveled with the Huarani, seeing firsthand the environmental impact of oil exploration on the rainforest and on their way of life. He befriended a tribe leader named Moy, who was invited to Washington by the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. In his new book, Savages, Kane tells of meeting with Moy in Washington. While in the city, Kane took him to see the White House.
At the White House gate, Moy reached into his bag and carefully removed his crown. It was made from owl, eagle, toucan, parrot, and wild turkey feathers, and when he jammed it down on his jet-black hair, a thousand colors seemed to burst from the plumes. But the gate was closed, and for a long time Moy stood and stared silently through the iron fence. Then he said, "That house looks pretty small. Are you sure the government lives there?" And I said, "The president lives here, with his family." "But where are the soldiers? Are they underground?" "Probably," I said, "and in back, and inside." He gripped the fence as if testing its strength, and his eyes narrowed in calculation. He went into the Huarani zone, as I'd come to think of it. When he returned, he said, "I believe I can climb this fence and reach the front door before the soldiers get me." "It will not work, Moy. It will not work if I do not try," he said. And I said, "The soldiers will be on you like a boa on a tree rat." And he said, "I will climb the trees and hide. I will pretend I am hunting monkeys." But I dissuaded him, at least for the moment, and we walked on. The sidewalks were full. Traffic roared. "There are so many cars," he said. "How long have they been here? 1,000,000 years? "Much less," I said. 1,000 years. "No," I answered. 80, perhaps. He was silent then, but after a while he asked, "What will you do in 10 more years? In 10 years your world will be pure metal. Did your God do this?" Dusk turned to night, and as we approached our hotel, Moy stopped beneath the street lamp. He pointed to the street. "More people, more cars, more petroleum, more chaos," he said. Then he pointed straight up at the light. "But there are the Huarani, all alone in the middle of the world."
That's Joe Kane reading from his book, Savages. Moy had been brought to the States by the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, and they wanted him to testify before the Human Rights Commission of the Organization of American States. What did he want to say to that commission?
He wanted to say to the commission that oil companies, and specifically American oil companies, threatened to destroy the Huarani way of life. And he wanted the commission to come down and investigate, or as Moy put it, he said he wanted the whole world to see. He felt that if the whole world came down and saw what was happening to the Huarani in the forest, that people would stop it.
Was Moy persuasive at all with the commission?
Moy floored the commission. The only mistake he made was that we had practiced in the hotel the night before. He had written out a speech he wanted to make, but he was reading it, and he can write it about a third or fourth grade level in our terms. And I told him, "No, Moy, don't. Just speak as you naturally would." And he said, "Yes, speak like the jaguar, because the jaguar is really the most powerful being for the Huarani in the forest." And I said, "Yes, use your own words." And so when he spoke to the commission, he leapt out of the seat with the power of his oratory. But he spoke entirely in Huarani, which none of the commission could understand. And then somebody leaned over and said, "Okay, great, now say it in Spanish," which he did, and then was very persuasive. And the commission all leaned forward. And afterwards, everybody wanted to talk to him. And Moy had, you know, brought various things with him that he had hoped to sell for $1 or $2 here to raise transportation money going home. And he just gave it all away, spears, string bags, whatever he had.
Did he wear his crown?
He wore his crown. He brought a spear. He brought his blowgun, he brought blowgun darts, and he also wore a suit jacket and a sports shirt and tie and pants and shoes, which for him were like a costume. He loved it. They were coyote clothes, as he called them, cannibal clothes, the clothes he wore when he came to talk to cannibals, which the Huarani considered to be everyone outside their territory but them.
Well, you had first met Moy 2.5 years before that. You were actually working at the Rainforest Action Network, and this rather mysterious letter appeared at the network. Describe the circumstances of its arrival.
Well, it came out of nowhere, it seemed. I was at the Rainforest Action Network a day or two a month helping them out with their newsletter. I happened to be there one day when Randy Hayes, the director of RAN, found this piece of paper on his desk in a stack of other papers and pulled it out. It came in an envelope with no postmark and no return address. It was typewritten on a manual typewriter on a single piece of white paper, plain white paper. And Hayes couldn't read it because it was in Spanish, which he doesn't speak, so he brought it to me. At that time, DuPont and Conoco, a subsidiary of DuPont, had finished exploring an area of the Ecuadorian Amazon for oil, and they discovered 220 million barrels, which they proposed to extract over 20 years. They had invested $90 million in the exploration and were about a month or two short of making a decision on whether or not to go ahead with production, in which case they'd sink 120 wells and put in over 100 miles of road, et cetera, et cetera.
So what did the letter say?
Well, the letter said the Huarani were opposed to oil exploitation in their territory, and they said the company DuPont and others were discussing the lives of the Huarani in meetings in which the Huarani are not present. And it said that the Huarani would defend their land with spears from all sides because we are the bravest people in the Amazon.
Now, had you ever heard of the Huarani before you had traveled the length of the Amazon River a couple of years beforehand?
No, I had been through Peru and Brazil, and I did not run into the Huarani then. They're extremely isolated. There's only about 1,300 of them, and they have defended a territory the size of Massachusetts for as long as anyone knows. They're considered the fiercest forest people on the planet. They're spear killers. In fact, they're so isolated that their language is unrelated to any other on Earth, although, as I was to come and find out, some of the younger men speak Spanish. They've picked it up on their travels. The word Huarani had come up, and in fact, there are at least a dozen environmental and human rights groups involved in this campaign, either opposing DuPont, Conoco, or in some cases actually working with them, as it turned out, in secret negotiations. To confer the stamp of approval in exchange for a large foundation that would be set up. I called around to all these groups. Nobody could tell me how to get in touch with the Huarani. Nobody could offer any way of finding out whether that letter was for real or not. It was potentially a very powerful letter. So I left RAN, got an assignment from the New Yorker, and went down to Ecuador. The one clue we had was on the dateline on the letter said Coca, which is a little western, wild west sort of town in the Ecuadorian Amazon. I flew into Quito and then down into Coca and started to look for the Huarani.
Well, let's find out how you got there, because this is certainly where part of your adventure begins. You had the name of this town, Coca.
Coca.
And you had, I guess, some idea about how the Amazon works from your previous travels. Mm-hmm. But where did you begin? Where do you go when you don't have a detailed map to work off of?
Well, I had heard the story of Alejandro Labaca, a Capuchin monk. In 1987, Braspetro, the Brazilian national oil company, and apparently Texaco, well, it's not clear if Texaco is involved, but they're said to have been. In any case, they spotted the Tagiri, one of the fiercest of the Huarani clans. They spotted a Tagiri settlement by air and then sent a team of mercenaries after the Tagiri to clear them out of the oil zone. There was a skirmish. A couple of Tagiri apparently were killed. Some of the mercenaries were injured. And Alejandro Labaca, the bishop of Coca, heard about this. And Labaca had learned some Huarani from clans he had met on the edges of the territory. And he went to the oil companies and the military and said, look, please let me intervene and try to move the Tagiri away rather than have you kill them. So Conoco dropped Labaca in the Tagiri clearing, came back 3 days later and found his body pinned to the ground with 17 palm wood spears, each of them jutting out of his corpse like porcupine quills. His body had been punctured in 89 places, and of course he was dead. I had heard that story, so I went to the Capuchin mission, and I happened to meet Labaca's best friend, a priest named Jose Miguel Goldaras, who still had the 17 spears taken from Labaca's body. And I said, look, we got this letter. I'm trying to find out if it's real. How can I meet the Huarani? And he kind of studied me, and he said, you want to meet the Huarani? And he said, they're right over there. And he pointed to the back of the mission compound, and there was this funky little cinder block shed. And I walked over and knocked on the door, and a voice said in Spanish, are you coming here? And so I said, well, yes, I'm coming here. And the door opened, and I walked in, and there were a half dozen young men sitting there wearing T-shirts and blue jeans, not saying a word, just watching me. And one of them had a pair of headphones on, and he had a wire going from the headphones down to his right hip pocket. And to make conversation, I asked him in Spanish, I said, what are you listening to? And he looked at me very solemnly, and he said, I am listening to my pants.
Did the guy have a Walkman?
No, he just had the headphones. He wore the headphones. They were not connected to anything at all. He had the wire, and he tucked into his pants, and he just wore them around because he thought they were cool.
That's great.
And the joke was on me.
Absolutely. Joe Kane is our guest. His book is called Savages, and it's about a small tribe living in the Amazon called the Waurani, and it's about their fight to preserve their land and culture against oil companies, missionaries, and even environmental groups. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Kane, and his book is called Savages. You have an interesting photograph in your book. It's actually comparing your feet to the feet of a Waurani. And what's most striking is the fact that they have this, what could be described as an opposable toe, just the way you can move your thumb down. It looks as if they can move their toe down, or perhaps it's even permanently extended.
Well, they call themselves tree walkers. They spend as much as half their lives, waking lives up in the canopy, because that's where so much of the life of the rainforest is. And their feet over time adapt to walking on tree branches, or, for example, crossing rivers. They'll knock down a 40-foot tall tree, knock it over a raging river, and then use it as a bridge and just walk across the log, carrying, you know, up to 100 pounds at a time, and never fall off. And their feet curl so well around the trees, the trunks and branches, well, you could call it a deformity, but it's really an adaptation to a need.
What does Waurani sound like? Can you give us some words just to get us give us a feel?
What do I still remember? It's been a while. Mbotogobopa, which means basically I am coming here. It's kind of it's very nasal. And so my name, for example, they would try to say Joe,
right,
but it would come out Chong. So they just started calling me Chong all the time.
Well, I thought some interesting things about their language was you said the word for anxiety is the same word for kill, and that the word later didn't come until, I guess, the missionaries came.
Yeah, well, actually, what didn't come until the missionaries came was the word lazy. Later was a concept that the Waurani, you'd ask them, I brought a bunch of food with me into the territory once because I thought we'd be doing a long trek and I wanted to make sure there was enough. And the Waurani, of course, insisted that I break it all out, and they ate the whole thing. 3 weeks' supplies we ate in 3 days. It was just gone. And I said, geez, shouldn't we save some for later? And they just looked at me and said, well, what's later? I mean, you know, there's no refrigeration, for example. So the idea of keeping food or keeping anything makes no sense to them. There's no sense of hoarding within the culture. There's no place to hide anything. And the Waurani ideal is self-sufficiency. The idea is to be so in tune with the abundance of the forest that you can go out there and find whatever you need and support yourself that way. So there is no need to save things for later.
Did you learn when you were with them to live in the present tense? Because, boy, I think that's so hard to do if you live in our culture.
Yeah, no. I can't say that. I was always worried about what was going to happen next, for example. But it is something that I brought away from the Waurani, my experience there, which is that the Waurani do live so in the moment. I realize that's a cliche these days, but it's absolutely true, and they have to. There is so much going on around them in the forest all the time that they can't afford not to pay attention. And so their ability to concentrate and to see clearly is extraordinary and very inspiring. And I would see it translated when they came into, as they called it, my camp. After a while, the younger men were coming into the city and they would want to have a cannibal contact there. And I was, at one point, the only person they knew in Quito. You know, they would ride the buses up out of the territory using their spears for tickets. They knew if they made some spears that whenever anybody asked them for a ticket for the bus, they could just hand over a spear and that would work. And they would come to my camp and then they would hike through the city and they'd hike in single file like we were in a hunting, out on a hunting party. And we would go hunting at the local supermarket, the Supermaxi, as it was called, and we would stalk, you know, frozen chickens and bring them back, carrying them on our heads back to my place. But always the Waurani were watching, you know, watching, studying everything. And then they would come back and they could mimic all the people they had met. They could talk. For example, they did a great job of mimicking petroleum engineers, who have a certain way of talking, or of people like me, you know, writers coming down asking questions. They were just excellent students.
Well, you describe a trip that deep into the forest where you literally felt like you were starving to death. You were lost. You had hypothermia. Did you think, I'm not going to make it? I'm just not going to make it out of here?
Yes. I spent one whole night in particular knowing I was starving to death. We were on a trek, so we weren't hunting. And in any case, the Waurani can go for 8 to 10 days without eating anything and then sit down and at a single sitting eat 8 to 10 pounds of meat, a single adult Waurani male. So they can go. I couldn't. You know, I wasn't adapted for that. And we hadn't eaten for at least 4 days and were hiking a lot, you know, 20, 25 miles a day sometimes.
And this is pretty rigorous hiking, I can imagine.
In rainforest, yeah, in hilly rainforest, slippery, slimy, all kinds of things biting you all the time, and you're hacking your way through the bush as you go, and you hike from dawn till dark. And we were lost, and the Warani were lost. We were outside the territory they knew, and we had to cut down trees. We had come to a river. The trail had ended. We were at a river, and we had to float that river, and we didn't know if we were going further into Warani territory, in which case we might find help, or if we were going south and east toward Peru, in which case we could go for weeks without coming across any other people.
Is it pretty unusual for the Warani to get lost?
They get lost, but they don't see it as lost, and they expect that something will happen. The Warani are very, they're very realistic. As Nkeri said to me at that point, I asked him, I said, Nkeri, where are we? And he said, we are in the forest. Hmm. I said, yes, but where in the forest? And he said, well, I can't find the trail. And I said, what does that mean? And he says, well, it means we're lost. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, it means we might die. And it was a simple statement of fact, no hysteria attached to it, on his part anyway. And then we built our rafts, and 2 days later, some Warani found us in a canoe. They said they had been out on a hunting party and had this canoe piled high with monkey and wild boar, well, peccary actually, banana and manioc. And I asked them, I said, how did you find us? And they said, you can't hide anything from the Warani. And this is the sense they have, that even if they're lost, that they will figure something out. And they thought it was hilarious that we'd almost died. And, of course, every Warani I was hiking with had to tell the story about, you know, the cannibal who fell off the bridges, made little fluttering signs with their hands, and they all found that hysterical.
Well, I like the stories you tell about how they tell time, because I think it shows both their humor but also their ability to take in the outside culture and adapt it for their own.
Yeah, they... Well, in Kerry, for example, when he was one of the Warani men I got to know very well, Moy and Nanto being the others, and they're really who I write about in the book. But in Kerry was the first Warani I traveled with, and in Koke, he'd had me buy him an outfit for the forest, which was a camouflage hat, a faux Yves Saint Laurent belt, a pair of men's BVDs, and some cotton socks and some rubber boots. And that was it. That made him the coolest dude in the forest. And so I was, you know, setting off on this massive trek following a man in his underpants. But Nkeri already had a watch, and it didn't work, of course. I'm sure somebody had thrown it away or just given it to him because it was broken. But he would announce, you know, he would read it, and Moy would do it too. I'd ask him, what time is it? And they would say, it's 12 o'clock in Ecuador. It's 1 o'clock in the United States of North America. It's 2 o'clock in France. It's 3 o'clock in Japan. And it was this joke about, you know, keeping time by the hours. And even out trekking in the forest, Nkeri very seriously would announce, you know, today we will hike until 5 minutes after five. And of course, his watch didn't work. And I would ask him, Nkeri, when will it be 5 minutes after five? And he would say, in 1 hour and a half. And then we would hike for 8, 9, 10 hours. And he would announce out of nowhere, 5 minutes after five, you know, very seriously. And then we would make camp. But now in terms of, say, days, that was a different story. Mm. If I would see Moy or see Nkeri in the territory, and I'd be leaving, you know, Nkeri would say, you know, Chong, I will come to your camp in 22 days. I would say, okay, great. Will you be alone? And always, yes, I'll be alone. Then 22 days later, I would return. I'd be at my apartment after, say, doing errands in Quito, and I'd return home, and there would be, you know, 6 or 12 or 18 Warani standing out in front of the apartment, wearing their spears and their headdresses, scaring the bejesus out of the local folks just by their appearance, but right on time, 22 days. And they'd be there waiting for me, and then I would take them up into my camp where they would then start ransacking my apartment because, you know, I was clan by that point, so anything I had was theirs. You know, for Warani, the highest manifestation of that ideal state of self-sufficiency was to give away whatever you had because you had no fear of need. So they would come out wearing all my clothes, all my great cannibal nylon jackets and things like that, always holding things up and saying, is this waterproof? Is this waterproof? Is this waterproof? And then wearing my ties wrapped around their heads like crowns.
Let's talk a little bit about what the petroleum companies are doing deep in the Amazon rainforest. And this is an area rich in oil and a country in Ecuador that wants oil companies to come to their country because they have a huge foreign debt.
Yes, it's a country, let's put it this way, that certain parts of the country, which happens to be the leadership, wants oil, although there's growing resentment within the country about it. A graffito that you see a lot there is más pobreza equal sign, más petróleo equals más pobreza.
Meaning?
More petroleum equals more poverty. Texaco especially has been down there for 20 years. When the oil boom started and Texaco started it, it produced its first commercial oil in Ecuador in 1972. At that time, Ecuador was $300 million in debt. It had $300 million of international debt. After 20 years of oil boom, Ecuador now has an international debt of $12.5 billion. if you trace the graph of oil production and the graph of national debt, they're exactly parallel, or almost parallel. And after 20 years, you can't say it's an aberration. It's clear that the more oil that Ecuador produces, the further in debt it goes. The money, they call the money down there 24-hour dollars. It comes in from the United States, it's, you know, in terms of loans and such. And then it goes right back to the United States. It goes into personal bank accounts of the ruling elite. It goes into Swiss bank accounts often as well, and sometimes German bank accounts. And so the country, you know, most of the people down there realize that they're essentially their oil supply is being looted, and there is growing resentment about it.
So what do the Waorani want?
They know, as most people do, that you know, oil production will not stop. It's not realistic. But they want a moratorium until the technology is brought up to snuff. Most of the Indian groups in the Oriente know that there's much better technology employed in the United States because the United States has laws that address contamination. And they want American oil companies to at least use that technology in the Amazon. And they want the oil companies and the missionaries out of their own cultural process. They don't want missionary schools in their territory. They don't want oil company schools in their territory. They want Waorani in their territory. They want schools, but they want to run through the state's bicultural, bilingual education program. In other words, in which they would not only learn Spanish, but also Waorani, traditional Waorani culture would also be taught so that the ways of the parents would be remembered.
Well, Joe Kane, thank you very much for joining us today on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Joe Kane's book is entitled Savages. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.